Today is Wednesday, July 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The World Health Organization says don't get complacent about COVID-19.
There seems to be this persistent belief that summer's not a problem. Summer is a problem.
Plus new arrests under the national security law in Hong Kong.
Tony Chung, who is the convener of the pro-independence group Student Localism, has been arrested on the suspicion of inciting secession.
And two Indian teenagers make a big discovery. We'll have those stories and more next. The World Health Organization on Tuesday warned against complacency about new coronavirus transmission in the Northern Hemisphere summer, saying that the virus does not behave like influenza, which tends to follow seasonal patterns. Margaret Harris made the remark during a virtual briefing.
There seems to be this persistent belief that summer's not a problem. Summer is a problem. This virus likes all weathers, but what it particularly likes is jumping from one person to another when we come in close contact. So let's not give it that opportunity.
She also warned against thinking in terms of virus waves.
People are still thinking about seasons. What we all need to get our heads around is this is a new virus and it's behaving, even though it's a respiratory virus, and even though respiratory viruses in the past did tend to do this, you know, different seasonal waves, this one is behaving differently.
In Vietnam, officials are rushing to control a sudden new outbreak of COVID-19 after reporting one of the world's most successful control efforts earlier in the year. People in the economically booming country of 97 million worry the spike in cases in Da Nang will spread outward and force another nationwide shutdown like the one ordered for about a month through late April. Adam McCarty, chief economist with Mekong Economics in Hanoi, explains.
It could be another outbreak. It's really sort of scared the Vietnamese because they thought they'd got through it all. But as the rest of the world discovered, this thing spreads much quicker than you think.
A Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 tracker counts over 16.75 million cases around the world. In the United States, which continues to top the globe in the number of confirmed cases, U.S. President Donald Trump made a big shift from the more measured approach he's been taking toward the coronavirus recently. Trump is back to defending a malaria drug as a treatment for COVID-19. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani takes things from here.
The president says hydroxychloroquine is safe.
I happen to believe in it.
Those studies have shown it can do more harm than good when used to treat COVID-19. But the president's defending his decision to retweet a video of some doctors promoting the drug. One of whom said in the video, "You don't need masks. There is a cure."
A woman who was spectacular in her statements about it.
She's Dr. Stella Emanuel with a history of dubious medical claims. When pushed on those,
I thought her voice was an important voice, but I know nothing about her.
The president says things look good in large parts of the country.
It's corona-free.
And says even in hot spots, things are heading in the right direction. But Dr. Anthony Fauci worries they're actually getting worse in places like Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio.
That inkling of a percent increase of cases that are positive.
Telling the AP if they don't, they may see the kind of surge that's ravaged the Sun Belt. Florida and Arizona remain in dire condition, and Texas is still in bad shape, though Governor Greg Abbott says residents are finally getting the message.
Finally, really accepting the reality.
Never, ever underestimate an infectious disease outbreak.
The president says he doesn't always agree with Fauci, but that's okay.
I have a very good relationship with Dr. Fauci.
Though he appears a bit jealous.
And he's got this high approval rating, so why don't I have a high approval rating?
At a White House news conference, the president stressed several times Fauci works for him, as does fellow virus task force member Deborah Birx. People seem to like them.
But nobody likes me. It can only be my personality, that's all.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Hong Kong government says it's looking at postponing its September 6th legislative election over concern another surge of COVID-19 cases is causing. Earlier, I spoke with Ria Mogul in Hong Kong via WhatsApp about the Special Administrative Region's third wave of cases.
The government announced this week that they would
likely postpone the upcoming legislative council elections because of the spike in COVID cases that Hong Kong has seen over the past month or so. You know, they said that if the elections were to go ahead, people wouldn't adhere to social distancing and it would be quite difficult to enforce pandemic preventative measures, etc. Now, as expected, many Hong Kong residents and activists are very skeptical of the reason given by the government. They see it as a way for the government to suppress opposition voices. Now, for a little bit of background, earlier this month, the pro-democracy camp actually held a primary election, which saw over 600,000 people cast their vote. Democrats also last year swept the polls at the district council elections, winning all but one district. So, you know, it was going to be interesting to see what the outcome would be of these legislative council elections. Now, the pandemic, of course, is in full swing in Hong Kong. We're seeing more than 100 cases a day. But still, a lot of people say that this is not the real reason that the government are doing this. Joshua Wong actually tweeted that using the pandemic as an excuse was, and I quote, a lie, unquote. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that the Hong Kong government so far have been able to organize and deliver face masks to every single household in Hong Kong. They recently rolled out a package whereby every permanent resident got 10,000 Hong Kong dollars into their bank account. So they're saying, you know, if the government were able to do all of these things, then surely they can come up with some sort of contingency plan, or they can do some sort of online elections instead of cancel it completely.
Right. And speaking of elections, late breaking news on Wednesday is that four people have been arrested under the national security law. Rio, what can you tell us about that?
Tony Chung, who is the convener of the pro-independence group Student Localism, has been arrested on the suspicion of inciting secession. And him and the three others were planning to organize some sort of like group activity, I'm guessing, against Beijing or some sort of gathering. So that's why they've been arrested.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about was Benny Tai, the pro-democracy activist and professor at Hong Kong University, who was fired on Tuesday. Mok Tung Wing, who is the deputy convener of the Hong Kong University Alumni Concern Group, made this statement about the concerns he has about the future of academic independence in Hong Kong.
So I think it's extremely, extremely dangerous and also very alarming. And what you would expect, you know, being Hong Kong U as one of the top lock university in this territory, that you will be, the majority of the teaching staff will be facing a kind of an informal certainty that you will be constrained by these provisions. And the actual action.
So, Rio, what exactly happened?
So the decision was actually made by the university council, despite the university senate stating that there were not enough grounds to dismiss Benny Tai. Now, the reason Benny Tai was sacked was because of his criminal convictions for his role in the 2014 Occupy protest movement that he actually co-founded. Benny Tai has been teaching at Hong Kong University for nearly 30 years and had tenure at the institution. You know, Hong Kong University is one of the most respected university establishments in Hong Kong and even in the region. Of course, there is a lot of outcry, a lot of upset over the sacking of Benny Tai. You know, many teaching staff, legal scholars, activists see it as a huge blow to academic freedom. You know, tenure is supposed to protect this freedom so that scholars are free to examine and voice a variety of views. I actually read a tweet by a legal scholar earlier today who said that the case of Benny Tai completely erodes even that last bit of protection that tenure has to offer. Now, of course, since these national security laws came into effect On July 1st, Hong Kong has witnessed the disbanding of Democisto, which is a pro-democracy political party that was founded by Joshua Wong. We've seen multiple activists leave Hong Kong for overseas. They've been deleting their social media profiles. They've been asking editors to delete their published opinion pieces. So there's a lot of fear and uncertainty still in Hong Kong. And it still remains to be seen how the law will affect education and a free press. But when you have a university council that doesn't side with their teaching staff and with their students, a lot of people begin to really question the integrity of Hong Kong. And a lot of them worry that, you know, they too will be constrained by these laws in the future.
Reporter Ria Mogul spoke to me from Hong Kong. The European Union will limit the export of sensitive equipment that could be used for surveillance in Hong Kong as part of a joint response to China's new national security legislation in the region. Nicolas Pineau reports from Paris.
EU foreign ministers expressed grave concern about the newly enacted legislation, saying it restricts fundamental freedoms in Hong Kong. The ministers called for measures at both the national and EU level to restrict trade, review extradition rules, and halt any new negotiations with Hong Kong. This development is a message to Beijing expressing political support for Hong Kong's autonomy under the one country, two systems principle. EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said in a tweet that the coordinated response sends a clear message of solidarity with Hong Kong's people. Germany's foreign minister, Heiko Maas, who currently chairs the regular meetings of foreign ministers under his country's Council of the EU's presidency, also welcomed the new measures. Maas also noted that his country already took a first step by immediately halting exports of military equipment and so-called dual-use goods to Hong Kong, as it already does with China. A review of the implementation of the national security law and the impact of the EU response package will occur before the end of the year. Nicolas Pinel for VOA News, Paris.
And coming up later,
millions of people are trapped here waiting out a war that may leave them permanently displaced. They rely almost entirely on food from aid trucks to survive. And families say they fear their chances of survival may soon go down.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Edwin Hubble provided evidence that the universe was expanding and developed the Hubble constant to determine the rate of expansion. Over the years, scientists have used a variety of techniques to measure the Hubble constant, which resulted in mixed calculations of the age and rate of expansion of the universe. Recently, a group of scientists headed by the University of Oregon took the known distances of some 50 galaxies from Earth to calculate the Hubble constant and determine the age of the universe. While it's thought that the universe is around 13.77 billion years old, the Oregon group determined that it's about 12.6 billion years old and is expanding at a rate of 75.1 kilometers per second for each 3.3 million light years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Muslim pilgrims donning face masks and moving in small groups are in Mecca for the start of a historically unique and scaled-down Hajj experience reshaped by the coronavirus pandemic. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Rather than standing and praying shoulder to shoulder in a sea of people from different walks of life, pilgrims this year are social distancing, standing apart and moving in small groups of no more than 20 to limit exposure and the potential transmission of the coronavirus, and eating pre-packaged meals alone in their hotel rooms. While the experience is starkly different, it remains an opportunity for pilgrims to wipe clean past sins and deepen their faith, the Saudi government is covering all the expenses of travel, accommodation, meals and health care. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Millions of people have been trapped in northern Syria for years, isolated between battles and borders and relying almost entirely on food aid to stay alive. Earlier this month, the United Nations voted to stop using one of only two international borders open for aid, And now the coronavirus pandemic has spread into the region. Activists say food and medical supplies for civilians are now being used as a weapon of war. VOA's Heather Murdoch brings us the story.
Many of the tents here were sewn together by hand, and women cook on homemade stoves made of rocks. It looks like 100 years ago, but it was actually an ordinary day last week in northern Syria, near the Turkish border. Umm Abdu, a mother of 8, came here a year ago. She says her family stayed home as long as possible, sleeping outside during the shelling. Millions of people are trapped here like her, waiting out a war that may leave them permanently displaced. They rely almost entirely on food from aid trucks to survive. And families say they fear their chances of survival may soon go down. 2 weeks ago, a United Nations resolution said aid trucks can only use one of the two international borders previously available to them. Aid organizations say the move is bound to greatly reduce the amount of food and medicine here, putting lives at risk. Analysts say the vote for the resolution was highly politicized, with Russia and China vetoing a renewal of aid packages until they all agreed to reduce access to only one border. Russia has said the borders are mismanaged by militant groups. But Russia supports the government of President Bashar al-Assad, and displaced families in northwestern Syria mostly fled the last rebel stronghold. This is activist Ahmed Khouja in Idlib. He says the Syrian war has reached a new era. There is a lot less bombing, but civilian food is now a weapon. And only days before the UN resolution, northern Syria took another blow. The coronavirus pandemic finally reached this isolated region that has only one testing machine and 95 ventilators for more than 4 million people. Doctors say if there is a widespread outbreak, containing it will be nearly impossible. Dr. Mohamed Salam from WHO Early Warning Alert and Response Network says that before the pandemic arrived, the region did not have nearly enough capacity to keep people healthy. If it becomes widespread, experts say pre-existing conditions and malnutrition could cause the COVID-19 death rate to be drastically higher here than almost anywhere else. Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
The U.S. military on Wednesday unveiled plans to withdraw about 12,000 troops from Germany following a decision by U.S. President Donald Trump. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper said nearly half of them will remain in Europe to address tension with Russia.
Nearly 5,600 service members will be repositioned within NATO countries, and approximately 6,400 will return to the United States, though many of these or similar units will begin conducting rotational deployments back to Europe.
To learn more about the plan and what it specifically means for the European U.S. and Africa Command, both based out of Germany, I spoke with VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden.
Well, most of the impact is going to be on U.S. European Command, again, which has been more heavily stationed in Germany than anywhere else. As of right now, there are about 36,000 to 38,000 U.S. troops in Germany at numerous installations, many of them famous and well-known, such as Ramstein Air Base. In addition, Stuttgart, Germany, has been home to U.S. European Command. European Command now is going to move to Belgium, so Germany loses the U.S. European Command and about 2,000 troops as part of that. There's also the talk that U.S. Africa Command now may be leaving, though those plans are not set in stone, and another location, according to officials, is still up in the air. They haven't chosen anything. But clearly, the U.S. is sending a message to Germany. What that message is, it depends on whom you talk to. The president back in June made very clear at a White House news conference with the Polish prime minister that he thought Germany was being very unfair to the U.S. Germany is one of the NATO countries that is not meeting the spending requirements on defense. A few of them are, although defense spending has increased across the NATO alliance. Germany is spending less than 2% of its GDP on defense, and it's committed to spending more. President Trump says that's unfair. And as a result, he said in June, the U.S. was going to be reducing its footprint in Germany. Mark Esper was asked about this, about whether Germany was being punished, and Esper was adamant that while Germany should be spending more, that this was not a punishment, that these moves have been under consideration for quite some time, and the goal is to make the U.S. more flexible, more strategic, and better able to deter Russian aggression, especially on NATO's eastern flank. And he pointed to the rotational deployments that are going to be coming up, where U.S. forces will be sent to the Black Sea region, which is much closer to Russia than Germany is, as a way to deter Russia. And he said that was the goal.
Norbert Röttgen, who is a senior member of Chancellor Angela Merkel's government in Germany, has called the decision a move to weaken the alliance of NATO. Did Secretary Esper or anyone else at the briefing comment about what they thought this would do to the overall strength of the organization?
Esper and the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General John Hayden, said that they believed, in addition to the commander of U.S. European Command, also spoke, they all said that this is going to make the alliance stronger. It is going to make NATO and the U.S. more responsive to the threats that are out there, specifically in this case from Russia on NATO's eastern flank. And it's going to allow the troops to be more focused on that mission of deterrence.
One last question. Moving troops is not inexpensive, and Congress holds the purse strings. So how is this all going to be paid for?
Pentagon officials, including Defense Secretary Mark Esper, said that they will be working with Congress. They will be consulting Congress on the moves. They seemed to indicate that would be more on for the U.S. forces that are coming back. They said the rough estimates, and they emphasized that they were rough estimates, is that it's going to cost billions of dollars, probably under $10 billion.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. And finally, two teenage girls from India had discovered an earthbound asteroid by poring through images from a University of Hawaii telescope. The asteroid is presently near Mars, and its orbit is expected to cross that of Earth in about a million years' time, according to Space India, a private institute where the two 14-year-olds were receiving training. The young ladies were using specialized software to analyze the images snapped by the Pan-STARRS telescope in Hawaii, and they made their discovery in June. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The founders of the United States, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, changed the course of history when they established a nation built on the premise that government exists not to diminish or cancel the individual's rights at the whim of those in power, but to secure them. On July 8, 2019, Secretary Pompeo commissioned a group of scholars and activists to furnish advice on human rights grounded in America's founding principles and the principles of the 1948 Universal Declaration on Human Rights. This endeavor, known as the Commission on Unalienable Rights, recently issued a draft report. Welcoming the release of the Commission's draft report, Secretary Pompeo confirmed that the United States was founded on certain unalienable rights without which our efforts to protect and promote human rights is unmoored and therefore destined to fail.
America's founders didn't invent the unalienable rights, but stated very clearly in the Declaration of Independence that they are held as self-evident that human beings were created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Secretary Pompeo went on to say,
no one can enjoy the pursuit of happiness if you cannot own the fruits of your own labor, and no society can retain its legitimacy or a virtuous character without religious freedom.
It is clear that unalienable rights are central to who we are as Americans, and so they too must underpin our foreign policy, said Secretary Pompeo.
If we truly believe that rights are unalienable, inviolate, enduring, indeed universal, just as the founders did, then defending them ought to be the bedrock of our every diplomatic endeavor.
Indeed, America's commitment to unalienable rights at home has proved a beacon of hope for men and women abroad pursuing their own liberties. One such example is Soviet dissident Natan Sharansky. When he heard of President Ronald Reagan's evil empire speech while imprisoned, he said it was a ray of hope in the darkness of his punishment cell. "I am confident," said Secretary Pompeo, "that the American star will shine across the heavens so long as we keep a proper understanding of unalienable rights at the center of our unending quest to secure freedom for our own people and all of mankind."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.